Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 17th, 2011, St. Patrick's Day. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, the first part of a two-parter with Kai Troister on pH. In this episode, Kai will give us some background on what exactly pH is and why the P is lowercase, by the way, and why we should think of it in the mash tun and beyond. Well, if you're new to home brewing, would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page is on facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And you can find our iPhone and Android podcast apps on those respective stores. And we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, too. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag before we talk to Kai. We've got some good response from our homemade sauerkraut episode on Basic Brewing video this past week. Steve and I showed you how to we turned some cabbage into something much more tasty thanks to some naturally occurring critters in the cabbage. Greg says, being of Ukrainian heritage, sauerkraut is also quite prevalent in our cuisine. We make a large batch every fall, but added a couple more ingredients. We add bay leaves and whole black pepper. When the kraut has reached the desired level of fermentation, we bag it and freeze it. Didn't know you could do that. Removing the leaves and as many of the peppercorns as possible. It says, we also use coarse pickling salt instead of sea salt. Greg says, I'm not sure of the 2.5%, though. That's what Michael Tonsmeyer recommended on his blog. That's what we did. He says the women of the family just say, add to taste, and they're always right. Our favorite use is in varenicky, I can't. Not only can I not pronounce it, I can't spell it even when looking at it on the paper. Varenyky. Or pierogies. And instead of a mason jar for a weight on top of the kraut, he says we use a special rock. And Greg says the stone has been in our family for decades, the perfect size and shape for the crock, an absolutely essential ingredient. Very nice. I bet there are some beneficial bugs that are left over on that rock. Zabudabi on YouTube says, nice, I made some a few weeks ago. 2 heads of cabbage, 2 bay leaves, 6 whole peppercorns, 1/8 teaspoon red pepper flake, a handful of red grapes, hand crushed in a strainer, and add the juice only, and kosher salt. He says, I never measure. And grapes kickstart the fermentation and add a little sweetness. Very interesting. And Randy says, very much enjoy the shows. Thanks, Randy. As an alternative to putting a plate and weight on top of your kraut, try using a large Ziploc bag and fill partway with water. The bag will seal nicely along the sides of the container but still allow gas to escape. You'll lose much less kraut on the top this way. Very interesting. I appreciate those comments. After Steve and I shot our Basic Brewing video episode, I cooked up a bunch of the finished kraut that you saw on the show. What I did was I simmered some purple onions, or red onions, I guess some people say, in some butter, added some garlic, cooked some bacon in the microwave between some paper towels because my wife doesn't like all that grease, added that bacon to the onions after chopping it up along with some Polish sausage and heated all that up, and then added a bunch of sauerkraut, maybe a couple of quarts of sauerkraut, and brought that up to a simmer and kept that there for about an hour and a half. And wow, incredible stuff. Just amazing. The house smelled unbelievably good. And, I had some homebrew with it, too. Okay, before I get even hungrier, Kyle and I talked for a good long time, so let's move on to our conversation with Kai. Kai wanted to break the topic into two parts to give it justice. So next week, Kai will take us more in-depth into the experiments that he's been doing with pH and homebrew. But first, he starts with the basics. And the acids, too, I guess. Well, Kai Troister, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thanks for having me again.
We're going to talk about a topic that we went over. I think it was John Palmer and I talked about pH years ago, but I think it's time to come back to the topic and give it another run and give it a different perspective from your point of view. And I gave listeners an opportunity through Twitter and through Facebook to send in questions to ask you about it. So hopefully we can get kind of a different take on the topic. It is kind of a complex topic that, you know, I don't think a lot of people understand. So I appreciate your taking time in helping to explain it. The first question comes from Robert, who asks, for the average brewer, do we even need to think about pH? And would it be wise for everyone to test their water at least once? So that seems like the most important or one of the most important questions right there. Should everybody have to worry about pH?
Well, I don't think that every brewer should have to worry about pH. There are certainly many other aspects of the brewing process that one should worry about first. And then at some point in their brewing career, they may want to start thinking about pH, because by getting the pH into the proper range for mashing and then boiling and also fermentation, it is possible to make a good beer into an excellent beer. Some brewers, especially the ones that have somewhat extreme water conditions, they may want to think about pH earlier in their brewing career, just because it is necessary for them to actually pay attention to the subject. But one of the reasons why brewers just don't like to think about pH too much is it is somewhat of an abstract concept. Not really abstract but it's not as intuitive. It's not, you can't really feel it like mm-hmm. you can feel temperature, unless the pH is really, really low or really, really high, then it burns your skin. But it's different that actually, because you can't see it, you can't feel it, the only way we can test it is by measuring, and the way it's affected is somewhat of a mystery to many brewers, and that's something I want to address in this show today, to give brewers some idea of how pH can be affected. What are the principles that are actually behind pH, and how in many things it's actually fairly common. It's actually fairly similar to, for example, mixing two volumes of water with a different temperature that then settle at a medium temperature. And so similar concepts also exist with pH.
So if you're an extract brewer, do you have to worry less about pH?
I would say yes, you have to worry less about pH, because you don't have to deal with the mashing process on which pH has a big effect. But I'll later touch on the fact that actually malt extract and also mashes, they tend to settle at a pretty close to optimal pH. And as I said, just in the extreme cases, you really have to take care of things there.
So take us down the road. I mean, start at the beginning. I mean, what is pH? What are we talking about?
Well, pH is an expression of the concentration of free hydrogen ions in a solution. And even if you have just plain water, or particularly plain water, the water molecules dissociate into hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions. Not all of them, but a small fraction does. And that principle of dissociating or having hydrogen ions dissociate from something else is something very important behind pH. And pH actually the P in pH stands for the negative logarithm of 10 of the hydrogen concentration. And that's why it's important in general to really spell it with a lowercase p and a capital H. What it means with the logarithm of 10 is that a pH change of 1 actually means a concentration change of 10x. So if the pH drops by 1, then the concentration of these hydrogen ions increases by 10x. And if the pH rises by 1, the concentration of the hydrogen ions is 1/10 of what it was before. But that is not the whole story to pH, because at a pH level that we generally talk about in brewing, let's say something, if you want to take distilled water from a pH of 6 to a pH of 5, if you want to take 1 liter of that, it takes only 1 milligram of 80% lactic acid to realize this pH change. But that's a very, very small amount. And in brewing, you'll have to have noticed that it takes much more to actually get a smaller, even smaller pH change. And to fully understand what is going on there, you have to first understand the concept about the acids and the bases in chemistry. And an acid is a substance that can donate these hydrogen ions to the solution, and thus it's something that can decrease pH. Whereas a base is something that can absorb these hydrogen ions, and thus it would raise the pH.
So in theory, they could cancel each other out.
Yes, they could cancel each other out. One of the things that you may have done in chemistry class is to take an acid and a base and mix them and have them neutralize each other. And what you end up with is a salt. But chemists actually make a distinction between strong and weak acids and bases. And that's an important distinction. A strong acid is an acid that readily gives up all its hydrogen ions. Like, for example, an example for strong acid is hydrochloric acid. Because it gives up all its hydrogen ions immediately, that means it can cause a very high concentration of hydrogen ions, and that's a very low pH. And that also what makes it so dangerous. But there are also acids that are called weak acids. And those are the acids that are actually interesting to us when it comes to brewing or in general. Because what the characteristic that these weak acids have is that they don't readily give up their hydrogen ions. The amount of hydrogen ions that they actually give up depends on the current pH.
And the lower the pH number, the more acidic a solution is, right?
Yes, you could say that. So for these weak acids, the percentage of acid molecules that actually dissociated their hydrogen ion, that lost their hydrogen ion, and the percent and the ones that actually still keep their hydrogen ion, that percentage depends on pH. And it is such that the more hydrogen ions are already in solution, the less likely it will be for that acid molecule to give up its hydrogen ion. And this mechanism is, as I see it, one of the most important mechanisms when it comes to pH. Because the release of hydrogen ions is, or the ability of an acid to actually contribute to the hydrogen or to the amount of hydrogen ions depends also depends not only on the acid itself, but also on the current concentration in the solution. And as a result, there is a regulating mechanism in place that I will show later is used to make pH buffers, to make solutions that resist pH changes. And the point at which an acid lost 50% of its hydrogen ions to the solution and kept 50% of the hydrogen ions still to its molecules, that point is what the chemists call the pKa. It's the acid ionization constant. And that constant is different for various acids. For lactic acid, for example, it is 3.9. For acetic acid, which is vinegar, it's a bit higher. It's 4.75. So what's important to know with these weak acids is that if the pH of the solution that they're added to are one or more pH units above their pKa, their acid ionization constant, pretty much all of the acid molecules will have given up their hydrogen ions and thus will have contributed to lowering the pH. And if you think about what I said about lactic acid, which has a pKa of 3.9, and in brewing we generally have mash pH values that are above 5, at that pH, we don't really have to take into account that lactic acid may not give up all its hydrogen ions to effectively lower the pH. And earlier, I touched about the importance of pH buffers. And I also made a mention of, in distilled water, it just takes a milligram of lactic acid to change, for example, in 1 liter, the pH from 6 to 5. Now, the reason why that does not apply, for example, to changes of mash pH is pH buffers. And pH buffers is actually what matters most for pH in pretty much all cases, including brewing. And for a pH buffer, the pH of that solution is actually determined by the ratio of the weak acids that have lost hydrogen ions versus the weak acids that still have the hydrogen ion attached to them. And in many cases, like brewing, we deal with a mix of many, many different weak acids, but the underlying principle is still the same and the behavior is about still the same, except when we deal not really with a mix of different acids is, for example, when we have calibration buffers for pH meter calibration. This is a solution that has been designed to be at an exact pH, and it is used as a reference to calibrate pH meters. In mash and wort, but it's mostly amino acids, proteins, and to some extent, phosphates that act as pH buffers. And
so it's the ingredients of the mash itself that may buffer the effect of these acids that you add to the mash.
Exactly. It's the ingredients of the mash. It's the malt. It starts out with the malt that's brought in, and the amino acids and proteins and all that what's brought in from the malt, that provides the pH buffer, which we will see later, is the buffer that the water will fight against when it tries to raise the pH, and that's the buffer that lactic acid, for example, will fight against when you try to bring the mash pH down. And it's important to note that buffers are best at buffering pH. So the idea of buffering pH is that the substance resist changing pH as acid or bases are added. And that's best done around that acid ionization constant that I talked about earlier. And for brewing, I tested the buffer capacity of mash and malt, of mash and wort and beer over a fairly large range. And I found that in the range that interests us the most, between like 5 and 6, it is a fairly linear relationship between the amount of acid added and the amount of change in pH that I saw.
Hmm. Now, I know that you want to get into more detail in, later on, but is the 5-star chemicals product 5.2, is that considered a buffer?
Well, it says it's a buffer. It can be considered a buffer, but the problem that it has is that it is based on phosphoric acid as the acid that is in there. So it's based on phosphates. And I said earlier, it's just said that a buffer is best around or works best around the acid ionization constant of this acid. Unfortunately, phosphate doesn't really have a pKa close to 5.2. There is a pKa at pH 2.14, and there's one at 7.2. So it's not really expected to buffer well at in this region. And I've also tested it a little bit, and it doesn't really show any significant buffer behavior in the mash. And it's not just me, but it's also AJ DeLong, who has done a lot when it comes to brewing science, and he has also seen similar experiences with this product. And I talk to brewers also about it, and it's oftentimes that they don't really see it buffer lock the pH at 5.2 or anywhere near.
Interesting.
But sometimes it does help, and I think that's because this product seems to limit the pH from rising higher than a 5.8, 5.9, and that may be enough to cause an improvement.
So we had a question from James who said that he's made 6 all-grain batches, and they've all turned out great. But on the last couple of batches, he used the 5-star 5.2. However, he says he can't notice any difference in the final outcome. And he was asking if he threw his money away on 5.2, or or is it cheap insurance to make sure his pH stays in check? So I guess it may be insurance if he's got some issues with pH?
No, well, it could be seen that, but I'm not in that camp. I think that he may have thrown his money away, and he may have been better off in getting some pH test strips and testing mash pH and then adjusting as necessary, or getting a water report, and I'll get into that later on. To get an idea of what the water needs or what the mash needs as adjustment to actually get the pH into a more optimal range. Once you have a buffered solution and you are in the area where the pH is buffered very well, the pH change depends on two things now. It depends on, or it's proportional to the amount of acid that you add. So the more acid you add to that buffered solution, like the mash, the more the pH will change. And there's a linear relationship between the change in pH and the amount of acid added. And the pH change is inversely proportional to the amount of buffer substance. That means if you have twice the amount of malt in your mash, it takes twice the amount of acid to get the same pH change, or you could just get half the pH change if you have the same amount of acid. That's something I'll get into when we talk about mash pH adjustments, how the mash thickness actually matters, or in other words, how the amount of water matters little compared to the amount of malt that's actually in the mash.
Ah, interesting.
And that certainly makes pH calculations much easier, because now you can work with this approximation, which is a linear relationship, whereas other formulas, like the one that I brought earlier, which resulted in a very tiny amount of acid being needed to change pH, that formula involves dealing with logarithms.
So we had several questions on how to measure pH. I mean, Eric says, what are the best inexpensive ways to measure pH? Robert says, are the paper pH test papers accurate enough? Jeff says, Jeff Karpinski, by the way, says, based on his earlier testing, does he recommend color fast strips? And Bill says, are the inexpensive eBay digital pH meters worth it? If not, stick with paper or go with a nicer meter. He's also measuring for mead as well. So, I mean, what are our options as far as how to measure pH?
Well, the options that we have, they range from very cheap and fairly imprecise to fairly expensive and fairly precise. So the easiest way, or the cheapest way of pH testing, is probably something you know, remember from science class, this the litmus paper,
mm-hmm.
where this is actually based on a pH indicator that's made from lichen. And those pH indicators, those are acids themselves. They're also weak acids, like I mentioned earlier, which is why they're so important to pH, to everything pH. And the acid that still has the hydrogen ion attached has a different color than the acid that has dissociated from the hydrogen ion. So as the pH change, as I said earlier, the ratio between the two changes. And if the ratio between the two changes, the color changes. And that's how these pH indicator-based testing methods work. Now, litmus paper is cheap, but the color change per pH change is fairly small. So you need a fairly drastic pH change to get a noticeable color change. And so the resolution is not good enough for brewing, because you can't really discern between, let's say, 5.2 and 5.6. With these litmus paper strips.
Ah.
An interesting fact is that, for example, red cabbage juice is a pH indicator as well. And if you go to my website and look at the site about on the page with for pH overview, you'll see a pH series of cabbage juice that I have there, which goes from yellow all the way to, I believe it was purple.
I'll be darned.
Or red, actually.
But more accurate than litmus paper or cabbage juice is is color fast strips. Are they a bit better?
Yes, they are better. So these color fast strips, They're also a pH indicator, but what they did, well, what the manufacturers did, they created a product that has a better resolution, so actually it's easier to distinguish the color reaction between 5.2 and 5.5, for example. And more importantly, the color doesn't leach or doesn't run out of these strips.
Mm.
And I consider them actually a fairly cheap alternative to pH meters. But when I did experiments where I collected samples of these strips from various brewers and compared the color reaction, or compared the measurements taken with these strips to measurements taken with a pH meter, I found on average an error of about 0.3 pH units. And it was such that the color fast strips tend to read pH about 0.3 units lower than what the actual pH is.
Hmm.
So if I had a wort that or mash that was at pH 5.5, those strips would, the color on these strips would align more with the color for 5.2 that was given on that little color scale on the package.
Yeah, and one thing about the color scale on the package, if it spends a lot of time in the sun with you as you're brewing on the patio, say, there's a chance that it may fade and you may have a more difficult time getting an accurate reading and trying to match it to the match your color strip to the package, I would think.
I can see that. While I was talking about light and color, you also have to read these strips in incandescent or sunlight. If you use them in fluorescent light, actually the strip will have, like the test strip will have a different color than in regular light.
So it's color fast strips are a little better than the cabbage juice, but but not as good as the pH meter, which is the most expensive and, as you would hope, the most accurate.
Yes. That's correct. Although pH meters seem to or can be had as cheap as, I think, $30 or so.
Oh, that's not bad.
And that, well, it's that comes, so what the cheaper, the less accurate and the less features they have. But I consider, a pH meter the best option for pH measurements for the brewing enthusiast who actually wants to take full control over pH in his or her brewing. And the way they work is that pH probe, that little glass bulb that you see at the end, that converts pH, so to speak, the concentration of hydrogen ions, it converts that into a voltage. And this voltage is a linear function of the pH that they are immersed into. And if you remember from school, a linear function is determined by a slope and an offset. And both these things is what you calibrate when you calibrate your pH meter in buffer solutions. And most common are buffer solutions of a pH of 7, and we brewers would then also use a buffer solution with a pH of 4. So that you can calibrate that pH meter. Some pH meters only have one calibration screw, and I think that's only used to calibrate the offset of the function, and you cannot compensate for a change in the slope as the pH probe ages.
So it's important, no matter how expensive a pH meter that you get, it's important that you calibrate it properly or else you don't know what you're getting.
Yes, so if you buy a pH meter, you should also buy buffer solutions, should buy storage solution, because pH meters do require maintenance and proper storage, which, for example, the ColorFast strips don't require.
Yeah, ColorFast strips are sounding better all the time, for me at least.
Oh, there's nothing really wrong with them, but you have to keep in mind that they might be reading a bit low, and at least in my and other brewers' experience, we showed that. And with the pH meters, you have models that have automatic and others have manual calibration. I used to have one that had automatic calibration, and that calibration went nuts at some point. I couldn't really use it anymore, and I now have one that has manual calibration, and I actually prefer that over the automatic calibration because I have more control over it. There's not as much electronic that can break. Many pH meters have what's called ATC, or automatic temperature correction. And what brewers should understand that this automatic temperature correction that only corrects for the change in the response of the probe. It does not correct for the actual change of pH that's happening as a liquid is heated up. And a major source of confusion for brewers is, well, do we worry about the pH at mash temps? Or do we worry about the pH of a room temperature sample? Because maybe you have heard that there's always this 0.3 3.5 conversion offset mentioned between mash temperature and room temperature. And some brewers question, well, are we reporting pH, or are we targeting pH values at mash or room temperature? And my take on that is that pretty much by convention, we always report pH values of a room temperature sample. That just in the literature, the most sources I have read, they always give the temperature, give the pH of a room temperature sample, even if the mash was conducted at a higher temperature. And it's also important to know that if you have a pH meter, that it is better for the health of the probe if you use it on cooled samples, as opposed to just sticking it into the hot into the hot mash.
You've got to take care of your probe. Sorry. So now, are you ready to talk about the effects of pH?
Yes. The effects that pH has in brewing, all these effects, in essence, actually fall back to changes of the ionic charges of these weak acids that are everywhere, that are on proteins, that are amino acids. And these things, as the pH changes, these acids change, and that causes these effects that we are seeing. For example, the enzymes and mashing. Because the pH can change how many of these acids lost hydrogen ions and which didn't, they can change which of these actually start attracting each other on a protein, on which are now starting to repel each other. And with that, they change the shape of the protein. And there is an optimal pH at which the shape of that protein, that enzyme, is just right. And different enzymes have different pH optima because they have a different configuration of amino acids and a different shape. And in mashing, we are mostly interested in the beta amylase and the alpha amylase. For beta amylase, the pH optimum has been reported to be between 5.4 and 5.6. Again, all these numbers that I give here are the numbers for room temperature samples of a mash.
Mm-hmm.
And for alpha amylase, the optimum is a bit higher. It's between 5.6 and 5.8. But because there are other benefits to actually having a somewhat lower mash pH, that causes us to target a pH that is a bit lower than at least what's for the alpha amylase. I consider a pH between 5.3 and 5.5 a good pH for pale beers, or beers that are brewed predominantly with enzymatically strong malts. Whereas if I go for decoction mash or beers that have more darker base malts, I like to change the pH a bit higher, between 5.4 and 5.6, so that actually I enhance the activity of the alpha amylase a bit more.
So listener Jay says, as far as a stout goes, for example, is pH really important to the complexity of the style, or can a brewer fake it in the brewing process? So can you get around having an improper pH for that particular mash in some way?
I don't really think that you can get around having a proper pH. I mean, I think the pH range that is acceptable and where the mash would still work reasonably well is actually fairly large. I think between 5.2 and 5.7, 5.8, that probably works. So, but it's still been beneficial to kind of get to that more optimal pH, and all, because also mash pH sets the pH for the following brewing steps. Mm. And I'll get into that later. How does pH affect subsequent steps? So there's nothing really that you can fake there at least as I'm aware of, in the brewing process to compensate for an suboptimal pH.
So the first reason that pH is important is because in the mash, your enzymes are going to just work better and get the most out of your malted grain, essentially, with the pH that they're comfortable with.
Yes, that's correct. And the next step that we have to worry about is the sparging step. And it is such that there's always tannin extraction from husks. It's just the nature of getting this vegetative matter into water, and there will always be extraction. But the higher the pH is, the more tannins will be extracted. Actually, a higher pH makes those tannins more soluble, and that's why you get more of them.
Hmm.
And some people say that a pH of 5.8 is the upper threshold that you shouldn't cross when you sparge. But I have not really seen that value, that number outside the home brewing literature. However, I think it's a good idea to keep the pH during sparging lower than 5.6. And if your pH, if your mash pH is, let's say, at 5.4, you still have a lot of buffer capacity in that wort that you have there in the mash, that unless you have very alkaline water, that the water will not really be able to bring up that pH all that high unless you sparge so much water that you seriously dilute what is left in the grain. And that's with this dilution, you actually deplete the buffer capacity that exists in there. And now the water, the alkalinity of the water, which works as a base, it actually can absorb hydrogen ions, raises that pH in the sparge.
So the more you sparge, the less of a buffer, the higher the pH, and the more the astringencies are created from the tannin extraction.
Yes. And I believe one of your listeners also asked about, do I have to worry about pH in batch sparging? Well, I don't think you really have to worry about it, but it's such that in batch sparging, because of this inherent efficiency limitation, because of the fact that there is always pretty substantial amount of sweet wort of extract left behind, even with the last sparge, that actually provides oftentimes a sufficiently strong buffer to keep the pH during the sparging process down. It is in particular with fly sparging that if during sparging the pH can become a problem. If, for example, you have channeling, and in these channels, you really completely rinse out all the extract that is providing this buffer, this pH buffer. And because you rinse it out completely, now the pH of the water is what dominates it, and that pH can be fairly high, and then you would extract tannins in that region where you have that channel.
So Philip was the one asking about whether pH is more or less important with batch sparging, and Trevor asked about brew in a bag, whether pH is important with brew in a bag, and it seems like brew in a bag and batch sparging are similar in that regard, in that you're not running a whole lot of water through your grain, so theoretically pH would be less of a concern with those two.
Yes, the pH concern in brew in a bag is the same pH concern that you just have with just regular mashing. So because in brew in a bag you just have the mash and you just pull out the bag, you don't have the sparge step. So yeah, you want to make sure also that at that point you actually make sure that your pH is in the proper range.
So what happens after we get out of the mash tun?
So once we get out of the mash tun, we get into the boil kettle. And even there, pH matters. And what pH does, again, as I said, pH changes the charge, the ionic conditions on the protein. And there is a point, a pH, at which actually the overall charge of the protein can become neutral, so that the protein itself doesn't have really electrical charge anymore. And that's called the isoelectric point, and it's an important point. It's an important pH, because at that pH, the protein becomes least soluble and becomes most likely to precipitate. And it has been shown that a boiled pH of about 4.9 gives the best protein coagulation. So that's the pH at which you get the most protein coagulated out of the wort. But given other considerations, it is generally accepted that between 5.2 and 5.4 as a boiled pH, again, measured at a room temperature sample, is a more practical pH to work with. And that if you have the pH in that region, you can actually expect a sufficient coagulation of proteins and thus not better haze stability in the final beer.
So how are hops affected by pH?
Right, and hops also are, or the hop utilization in particular, is also affected by pH. The alpha acids actually are more soluble at a higher pH, and thus the higher the pH is, the better hop utilization you'll get. But the hop character you get from a higher pH tends to be a bit harsher and not as refined. And I actually prefer the smoother bittering quality that I get from a lower boil pH, even though I may have to add more hops to compensate for that. But I don't think that, or actually I know that none of the hop utilization formulas that we currently use take pH into account, even though it can actually have a fairly dramatic effect on the hop utilization.
Now, all that is happening in the boil. You don't necessarily adjust pH during the, or you don't, I don't hear a lot of people talking about adjusting pH in the boil.
You can do that. And thanks for touching on that. I have started doing that as well after reading about it in German brewing text. There's the idea that you acidify both the mash and the wort. And you would only acidify the mash to get to a mash pH of, let's say, 5.45 or 5.5, and then you would get better enzymatic activity in the mash, and then you would, in the boil kettle, you would further acidify the wort to actually get a more optimal boil pH, and then also a lower cast-out wort pH. And the idea of the lower cast-out wort pH comes to feeds into the next topic, is how does pH, or what has happened to pH during fermentation?
So it doesn't stop at the kettle.
It doesn't have to stop at the kettle. And during fermentation, the yeast needs a low pH environment for efficient nutrient uptake. Actually, the inside of the yeast has a higher pH than the outside, and it's the yeast that actually actively works on keeping it that way through the excretion of organic acids and also through an active transport of hydrogen ions from the inside of the yeast cell to the outside. And this pH gradient that they are building up, that actually facilitates the nutrient uptake. And at the end, the final beer pH tends to be between 4.2 and 4.6. That's what I have seen and also measured on my beers. And one of your listeners had a question, regarding pH in mead. And during fermentation. So one thing you have with beer, that malt extract, the proteins that you get from the malt into the wort and also the phosphates, they provide a fairly strong pH buffer. So wort and beer are inherently resistant to pH changes, and they also buffer the pH change that the yeast wants to accomplish. But that is not necessarily given in meat, for example, or in musts, where you mostly have a sugar solution, and sugar itself is not a pH buffer. It actually doesn't really keep pH from moving. And in these environments, it can happen that the yeast just drops the pH too far. I believe that meat makers and winemakers, they compensate for that. I'm not actually familiar how, but I believe that they have to pay attention to that.
So these are the basics, the beginning of our discussion on pH. What can we look forward to in the second half?
So in the second half, I want to talk about the more practical aspect of actually what affects mash pH, because that's what most of your brewers have questions with. And that's also touches on an area in which I have done a fair amount of research, where I have done small micro-mashing experiments to actually see how different malts and how different water compositions affect the final mash pH.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. I look forward to next week.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, thanks to Kai. I'll be posting links to the pages on his site in the description of this episode on basicbrewing.com, and I look forward to next week. And I thank all of you who submitted questions, and we'll be getting to more of those questions next time on the podcast. It is St. Patrick's Day. Be careful out there if you go out to celebrate St. Patty's Day. Remember, this is amateur night, the night that those who don't normally enjoy an adult beverage and don't know their limits are out on the roads. You be safe and smart, too. For me, I'm staying home. If you have boldly staying home, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our DVDs, Extract Mashing and or Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, and our 2011 logbooks are here too, and our other DVDs, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits, and our shirts as well on our store. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them from us in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Sounds like I'm celebrating St. Patrick's Day already, but I'm not. Saying thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are economical pH strips on vinyl wand with range 1.0 to 14.0, pack of 50. There you go. And Kenneth Cole Light as a Feather Upright Carry-On Red. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to BYO Magazine through our associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's it. Until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.